this, I think, you will find is the most unusual man, both from him and from me. Before I welcome him, let me also welcome my own special guest, Gordon Bilney, who's sitting next to John Button down there, a former Keating government minister and once my own local federal MP. Gordon, it's always a pleasure to see you and share a glass with you. I always remember that Liberal Senator Amanda Vanstone once told me she liked sharing the airline seat next to you on the way back from Canberra because she was always a short of a drink. John Norman Button was born in Victoria in 1933 and was educated at Ballarat College and the University of Melbourne. He entered politics for the ALP in the Senate in 1974, I think, John, is that correct? And remained there until 1993. He was Federal Industries Minister from 1983 to 1993, and I believe was a very effective minister in both the Hawke and the Keating governments. He is a distinguished lawyer who has served a number of business and government organisations over the years. So much for the professional John Button, although there's a lot more to him. I first met him not long after he entered the Senate. For some reason, we shared his Commonwealth car going from Sydney to Cronulla. At the time, I was working for the Sun Herald newspaper. I can't remember what the story was at the time, but I always remember that he was wearing a Mickey Mouse watch. This is not your average pompous politician, I thought to myself at the time. And one more thing. Some years ago, it was probably when you were leaving politics, John Button, I think, my old mate Doug Aiton wrote a full-page interview with you in the broadsheet Sunday Age in Melbourne. It was all serious stuff until the end when Doug said to you, John Button, "Now, Senator Button, when you're not doing politics and industry stuff, what do you like doing?" And you replied, "Well, I like playing tennis and rooting." And Doug Aiton said to you, "You can't say that in a family newspaper." And the Age printed this, by the way. "What do you really like doing?" And you said, "I like playing tennis and I like rooting." So I'm going to foreshadow a question to you, John Button. Do you still like playing tennis? Please come up and speak to us.
Oh, thank you, Chairman. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, the Chairman will keep till later. I think it's a pleasure for me to be here. I have to fumble with my notes for a second, then I'll tell you. I suppose I should begin, with one exception, by thanking the Chairman for his kind remarks in introducing me. I don't know why I'm here quite. I'm sort of quite surprised to be talking to a press club these days. I'm reminded of that great story of the founder of Webster's Dictionary, Noah Webster, who one day was working in his study and his wife burst into the room and found Noah Webster with his secretary sitting on his knee. And Webster was a great, you know, very concerned about the precision of the English language. And Mrs. Webster said, "Noah, I'm surprised." He said, "On the contrary, madam, you are astonished. It is we who are surprised." Well, I'm both surprised and astonished to be here. I have to say I needed a kindly introduction this week. On Monday night I was at a dinner party in Canberra. And if I might just name drop for a minute, it was attended by a number of luminaries, including the Prime Minister, three former Governor-Generals, Gough Whitlam, former Prime Minister, the Speaker and President, the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President of the Senate and so on. It was to honour a visiting dignitary. And a couple of days before this dinner, I saw Gough Whitlam in Sydney, and he said to me, "I'll see you at a dinner on Monday night." He said, "I've studied the guest list. You are the least distinguished person attending." Which I suppose you would say was true. I have to say that on the same occasion, he was sitting down, as he tends to do these days, and I was standing up. And he said, "Now, as you would say, we can talk on the level." Now, all this, I must say, with Gough Whitlam and myself, dates back many years. There's a famous story of J.K. Galbraith, the Doyen of American Economists, a great American, who in the early 60s found himself at the United Nations cocktail party in New York, standing next to General de Gaulle. He just had been president of France. And both these men were 6'8" tall. And Galbraith didn't quite know how to start a conversation with the general, so he said, "Mon General, has it ever occurred to you that people of our height are the natural leaders of mankind?" He said, "Look, round this room, everybody has to look up to us, and we look down on them." And de Gaulle, without a smile, looked at Galbraith and said, "You're absolutely right, and we've been insufficiently brutal to those who are too short." Now, Gough and I shared that story. He's still, you know, fantastic memory, but it was a sort of debating point between us. You see, in public life, you don't mind being put down by somebody like Gough Whitlam or anybody else if it is done with style and wit. One admires the art form. After I remember addressing an ALP audience in Melbourne not so long ago when the secretary of the Victorian branch of the Labor Party was there, and I asked a question which he didn't like, and he said, "You have to be very careful in answering questions of the superannuated glitterati." And I thought, well, that's clever. That's really clever, and I enjoyed it. You see, the problem nowadays is that we live in a society in which public life is characterized by witless men and women. There's not much wit in public life anymore. And that is a very sad thing, and it's why people like myself, I suppose, treasure the past. Anyway, it's nice to be back in Adelaide, and I thank you, Chairman, for inviting me. I know very little about what's happening in Adelaide. That's a function of ignorance. I remember, I'm a Geelong supporter, and I remember being in London once, and Bob Hawke and I were speaking at a seminar of British businessmen. And while Margaret Thatcher was also speaking at it, and while we were waiting to speak, somebody brought in a message from Australia. It was in 1989, this was from a friend of mine who barracks for Essendon. He said, "Bad luck, mate," the thing said, the telegram said, "Ablett suspended for 6 weeks." It was in fact 2 weeks, but he said 6. So I told Bob Hawke, and Bob Hawke, being primarily interested in sport, told Margaret Thatcher this terrible thing that had happened to me. And when we went to speak to this audience of 500 British business people, I spoke before Thatcher, and when she spoke, she said, "I disagree with Senator Button about one thing." But she said, "I excuse him on this occasion because I understand he's very distressed about the fate of Mr. G. Ablett." And all these businessmen wrote down on their pads, you know, they thought it was another Alan Bond or something, so they all wrote it down. Anyway, the end of the story is that when I got back to Australia and I went down to Geelong and I told Gary Ablett this story, and he looked at me with a rather blank expression, which he was good at, and it occurred to me at that moment that, you know, here you have these two famous people in different parts of the world, Margaret Thatcher and Gary Ablett, and neither had ever heard of the other. Now, these sort of things happen to us all. And, you know, I don't know much about South Australia anymore because we're particularly parochial in this country. We still are half a dozen population centres. You could read the Melbourne newspapers for weeks on end and not find any reference to Adelaide. And vice versa, I suspect. And that's a function of a parochial media which feeds an essentially parochial society. The only exception to that is sport, of course. I have to say that I know more about Andrew McLeod's hamstrings than I know about the state of the Australian government, the South Australian government, or the state of the wine industry, because sport has this universality about it. But this is a function, as I say, of an underpopulated country which still clings to a sort of parochialism of its own particular kind. Anyway, I understand the South Australian government is going quite well, which often happens with minority governments subject to the discipline of independence. Now, I was asked to speak to you in July, not long after I published a quarterly essay called Beyond Belief, which was subtitled, What Future for the Labor Party? I must say it seemed like a good idea at the time. I was doing a few speaking engagements, and the title, The Future of the Labor Party, was suggested to me. But time has moved on since July. And now I want to talk on a more general topic, which I would like to call Still Life with Reflections. Now, an educated and sophisticated audience like this will instantly recognise that there are numerous double entendres in that title. It's capable of various meanings, depending how you say it. It's like the Americans say, okay, it has about 50 different meanings. And this has a multiplicity of meanings too, you know, still life, still alive. People might be surprised to learn. But anyway, the title is important because it's appropriate, I think, because what I want to say is riddled, I suppose, with a touch of nostalgia. And I suppose, as it said, distance lends enchantment to the view, and it's perhaps a generational thing, what I want to say, but I think it is also a quality thing. Because what I really want to talk about is the decline in public life in Australia and the decline in public dialogue in Australia as I see it. Now, I must say that I blame my political party considerably for this, because it is an issue in respect of which the Australian Labor Party is extraordinarily important, in my view, not just to Labor Party members and its supporters, but it is important to national life and the future of this country. 4.25 million Australians voted for the Labor Party at the last federal election, and that was, of historical terms, a low vote. But I think we all have to remember, whatever our political position, that the ALP provides the only realistic alternative government in this country. You know, the Greens, for example, are a very vibrant party now, very attractive to young people. But essentially, they are a one-issue party. They're not a multi-dimensional party. The issue might be right. The issue, which is the one issue of the Greens, might be right, but that it doesn't make them a viable alternative political party. So the Greens have become a refuge for the political enthusiasm of the young, including most of my family at the last election, which I found difficult to cope with because I'm in a rut. But my point is that it's important in a democratic society to have an alternative source not only of ideas but of power. Idea and power in national politics are very important. And what it seems to me to have been lacking in recent years is an alternative, a sense of difference, if you like, an alternative agenda, which is publicly argued and articulated in this country. That is the sort of fundamental, I think, of virile discussion and debate in a community like this. What you have is two major political parties jostling for the middle ground and jostling for respectability. Now, I wrote the quarterly essay, Beyond Belief, because I was concerned about complacency about this issue, and particularly in the Labor Party, which has a long and times distinguished history. And what I wanted to do was to analyse what had changed in the last few years, in the last decade or so, which changed, in a sense, that sometimes proud history. I wanted to try and show why the student or voter of national politics sees little sense of difference between the two major political parties and how that came about. I just want to reiterate a point I've probably already made, that politics is essentially about ideas and it is about convictions. And it is also about political cultures. And, you know, the political culture of the Labour Party at the moment, not to mention the political culture of the Conservatives, about which I'm not an expert, perhaps, is a matter of concern to me. Can I illustrate it this way? About 4 months ago, after John Howard returned from America, the member for Werra, Mark Latham, made a public statement in which he described Howard as an arse-slicker and said that he hated members of the coalition. Now, I think the expression arse-slicker is not appropriate and is inelegant. Paul Keating would have put it much better, and I quote from what he would have said, "The Conservatives, you can bet on it, will forelock tug their way to Washington. And our future as an independent country, as a republic in Asia, in our neighbourhood, will be lost forever." That seems to be a better statement to me of Mark Latham's essential point. But in spite of Latham's inelegance, I have to say that the statement he made gave me a tremendous lift. Because it said to me, as a member of the Labour Party, we're different. We're different from this present lot. We believe in something different. We're against arse-lickers. The Labour Party stands against arse-lickers. And that seemed to me to be an extraordinarily important thing to say. But the other thing about Latham's statement was that for the first time in several years, it seemed to put the coalition government in Canberra on the back foot. John Howard was going around the country mumbling on talkbacks about polite language and impolite language and things like that. It was all rather pathetic. In the Parliament, Tony Abbott lectured parliamentarians about whether hatred was an appropriate motive for our distinguished parliamentarians ever to have. And, you know, it was an extraordinarily pompous, ridiculous little speech that Tony Abbott made. So, in a sense, that sort of illustrates my point about the sense of difference. It illustrates it in a very simple way, of course. So what in electoral terms this country desperately needs is a political party which will create and articulate an alternative agenda. An alternative agenda which is prepared to argue passionately, win or lose, in this community. It may lose, but when it gets that agenda right, it will win, as the Labour Party did in 1972 and nearly won in 1969, after articulating an agenda in Australia which was immensely unpopular in 1963 and 1966. You see, this capacity to argue an alternative agenda is the hallmark of Labour's greatest historical successes. Whitlam, for example, was the great agenda builder, I think, in Australian politics. You know, he really, in the 1960s, late 1960s and early 70s, argued an alternative agenda for this country. He put a whole lot of new political ideas on the agenda about cities, about the role of women, about services provided by local government, all these sort of things. And the ALP does better in that when it forces the Conservative parties into resistance to change, which is their natural role, resisting change. And the process of articulating an alternative agenda is very important in creating an alternative climate of ideas, because, as I said, politics is ultimately about ideas. So most of the quarterly essay, Beyond Belief, was trying to analyse how the ALP got itself into its present situation where it seemed incapable of doing that. And, you know, there were a number of things which contributed to that. The so-called small target strategy, not articulating policy. What I call the Christopher Robin posture. You get into bed and you curl up small and nobody knows you're there at all. And they hope, and then hope they'll vote for you. You know, the ALP, by the election last year, was buoyant with caution. And Australia suffered badly for that. Let me illustrate it with one thing. Our attitude to asylum seekers and refugees. You know, this may not seem an important point locally. But you see, if the world looked at Australia in November and December 2001... they would say, this country, everybody in this country believes that refugees, asylum seekers should be treated in this way. Everybody in Australia must believe it because there is no opposition. There is no opposition to the government's position. You know, that is a terrible thing for Australia, for the image of this country, and for the way other people regard us. And I have to say, I regard the way other people regard us as immensely important. Now, these things happened in the ALP, which, because of factionalism, which produces mediocrity, in my view, it's a charter for mediocrity, because of the composition of the Parliamentary Labour Party, which is much less diverse than it used to be. In Whitlam's day, in Hawke's day, the Labour Party caucus had an immense range of former occupations represented. Now it has very few. Nearly everybody in the Parliamentary caucus in Canberra comes out of parliamentary electoral offices. That's their experience. That's their life experience. And that is a narrowing thing. And the other thing the ALP seems to me to have done in recent years is to retreat from traditional positions which it's held, not just policy and intellectual positions, but from the broad base it espoused to represent. Nothing more dramatic in that context than the Labour Party's retreat from the bush. You know, when the National Party, which represents the sort of rural side of the coalition, was in dire trouble, the Labour Party took no advantage of that, because it had retreated in its own mind from the bush. And another factor which I think is very important for the Labour Party as a national party is its retreat from the rank and file. It is adrift from the rank and file of the party. Now, those things are not conducive to a climate of ideas, which is immensely important. So people wait for the policy review which has been announced. And in the meantime, there is a lot of frustration and anger, and I understand that because I got many letters about the quarterly essay expressing that frustration and anger. Why anger? Anger because a lot of people don't like the present government very much. It was elected with no sense of where the country might be heading, with very little understanding of where it would take Australia when it was re-elected. People are anxious about the lack of an independent foreign policy in this country. They're anxious about a retreat of this country from the region in which we live. They're anxious about the inward-looking nature of Australia, and they wonder where the spirit of the Olympics, which made us a very proud nation, now is. Where is it? Post-election 2001. Where is that spirit now? Not to be seen, I think. I think they're worried about growing inequality. We live in a society where 20% of families are dependent on social security as their prime source of income. Where 17% of children grow up in a society without a breadwinner. You know, they're terrible statistics. And people are concerned, I think, about those things. And what I'm really arguing is, you know, you really have to get some debate going in this country about these things, because the sense of difference about these issues is tremendously important. Now, I want to say a little about the environment of contemporary politics. We live in a time of conservative hegemony in national politics and Labour ubiquity in state and territorial politics. Some people marvel about that. But I think, you know, the essential difference is that state governments and territory governments are essentially about administration. They're not basically about fundamental political ideas. And I'll come back to that issue later. But there is a distinct difference. The Conservatives are in office nationally because of the unpopularity of the last Keating government, which was considerable. They're in office because they manage the economy quite well. They're in office because this is a time of uncertainty, And in times of uncertainty, people sort of close their minds. They're in office because John Howard is a very clever politician, and they're in office because the opposition in Canberra has not been good enough. The ALP is in office in the States because the Conservatives in most cases are worse. And politics in the States is less, I think, about ideas. It's not about the national ethos of this country or anything like that. It's very much more about administration. But let me just concentrate on national politics for a minute. National politics in this country defines what Australians are. It determines our relationships both with ourselves and the world. It determines our image in the world. It determines the future of our basic institutions, like our universities or our hospitals. Essentially, these things all depend on a national government. And as I've said, why I think this government is in power, I also have to say that I don't think it's in any sense been a mesmerising government. The sole purpose of coalition politics seems to be there, and it may be the sole purpose of the contemporary Labor Party. Tim Colbatz, writing in the Melbourne Age on the 3rd of September, put it this way, and I quote, 10 months after the election, the government conveys no sense of leading us somewhere. It deals with cases as they arise, from Iraq to liability insurance. But other than selling Telstra, its third-term agenda seems to be simply to win a fourth term. Now, that changes the nature of politics, in a sense, you know, if that is the sole agenda of a political party. Because in that context, there's not a glimmer of vision about this country. It is a reactive government in that sense. And I have to say, sometimes it has very good reactions. John Howard's reaction to the shootings in Port Arthur was a good reaction. The reaction to Timor was a good reaction. Sometimes it has bad reactions. But you see, I sense that in an extraordinary way, people are seeking more than that, and it's not forthcoming in the federal parliament. There's a lot of talk in the newspapers, a lot of letters to the papers and so on, about leadership, about political leadership, what it means. Paul Keating, with his Placido Domingo speech, was the last political leader who ventured into these dangerous waters. He said in that speech that we'd never had a leader in Australia and we were waiting for him, essentially, was what he said. The language of politics, of course, is very different today, and it's interesting to reflect on the idea of leadership. A month or two ago, I was asked, of all things, to give the Daniel Mannix Memorial Lecture in Melbourne by the Jesuits. And the topic they gave me was imagining leadership. Imagining leadership. Now, that's what a lot of Australians have to do at the moment if you think about what political leadership might and ought to be about. The present Labor Party is... There are two sort of brands of leaders sometimes categorised by psychologists. One is called transactional leaders, and the second are called transforming leaders. Transactional leaders are people who do deals. You know, the Labor Party is cluttered with transactional leaders. In factional affairs, they learn how to negotiate round the table, do deals and all that. And it's very interesting sort of to look at particular political leaders we've had here and see whether they're transactional or not, or transforming. I mean, Bob Hawke seems to me to be quite a good mixture of both. And John Howard, it might be argued, has something of both in him. But the problems of whether we have transforming leadership or not are hardly relevant now, because I don't think we do have transforming leaders in Australia. And this idea of transforming leaders is very much mixed up these days and cluttered with the sort of garbage of contemporary politics about conviction politicians. You know, John Howard is a self-defined conviction politician, which distinguishes him, or distinguished him in the year, last couple of years, from Kim Beazley, who he identified as not being a conviction politician. So it's good to be a conviction politician. But that's very simple. You have to understand and give some thought to what the convictions are before you say that that is a necessarily good thing. You see, according to, I think, proper definitions of political leadership, the only politician in Australia that I've seen do anything in the last 5 years which might be described as conviction politics is Claire Martin in the Northern Territory. Anybody who goes into an election as the underdog with 74% of the population of the Northern Territory in favour of mandatory sentencing, anybody goes into that election committed to getting rid of it is a conviction politician, in my view. But if anybody else can think of other examples in Australia in the last few years, please let me know at question time. There are a number of things, I think, which influence what I would call the abdication of leadership in Australian public life. So I think the real test of leadership is the capacity to face up to difficult issues and then present others and persuade others to do the same. You think about them, the historic leadership models. When you take Winston Churchill, I mean, Winston Churchill was probably for most of his life a disastrous politician. But as Christopher Hitchens has said, in one moment of his life, he got it right, which was the most important moment of his life. And that involved standing up his whole war cabinet, or most of it. See, John Curtin got it right when he persuaded the Labour Party to accept conscription for military service. That was a courageous leadership decision, which he arrived at alone and persuaded his political party to do. Whitlam got it right when he dealt with the issue of aid to government and non-government schools. And Bob Menzies got it right. You know, when he, invited the Japanese industry delegation to Australia in 1950, an extraordinarily unpopular decision, but a right one, as history proved. Now, this sort of leadership is now absent, I think, in Australia. There are a number of reasons for that. One of them is subservience to a particular economic ideology, and another is the dominance of what I would call focus groups. Now, focus groups are engaged in by the political parties, professional interviewers and consultants. In the Labour Party in the last election, they had focus groups in 28 electorates. And these people are enormously influential, I think, in the formation of political policy in Australia now. You know, people are interviewed, surveyed, discuss issues, and those issues are sorted by professionals and conveyed back to political parties. You see, the thing about focus groups is that they seem to me to illustrate followership rather than leadership. You follow what the focus groups tell you rather than lead in the sense of facing up to difficult issues and persuading others to do the same. And there are several other examples, I think, of followership in contemporary Australian politics. See, I think myself that we have to be very careful about following American leadership in an unthinking way. A little reflection of the kind which characterises real leadership would surely lead to the conclusion that this may not be the best course for us in Australia, that it may not be in Australia's national interest. Our eagerness to participate in the war in Iraq, if it comes, doesn't, in my view, indicate thoughtful reflection. An article in the Los Angeles Times recently, which was published throughout this region, and I want to refer to it because it just makes the point I was trying to make earlier, that what other people think about it is very important. This article was published in the Straits Times, China Post, a whole range of publications in this region. And it was quite, you know, it, it was analysing a speech John Howard gave at the Chamber of Commerce in Sydney a couple of weeks ago. And what it essentially says is that Howard made a good speech, a thoughtful speech, about the so-called war on terrorism. But then he sort of blew it in this way. He chose, the writer of this article says, then to becloud, if not befoul, his position, when he added the following. Whatever the pros and cons of an Iraqi attack, Australia, he said, supports the Americans and the British because of similar values and a similar view of life. We support them because of similar values and similar views of life. The author goes on, the author of this article. That sounded racist, and it's pretty unfortunate. Consider now that all the targets under consideration by the West, the terrorists, Iraq, Iran, are Muslim. What Howard in effect did was to invoke the us against them, white against non-white, Western versus Islamic showdown that makes every intelligent person shiver. Now that doesn't seem to me, I'm just illustrating this to try and make the point that, you know, if you're going to be a follower as distinct from a leader, you have to be very careful about it. Very careful indeed. Otherwise, it's not good for this country. And that, of course, is classic followership. I referred also to the reliance on focus groups, which seems to me to put politicians in limbo and derogate from the functions of both a good bureaucracy, in some ways the function of the media, and certainly the function of political parties. You know, if politicians are going to rely on professional survey people to get all their views, the function of bureaucracy seems to me to be considerably derogated from. So does the function of a political party, and in some ways the function of the media. The Australian bureaucracy, I have to say, has declined immensely in the last few years. There are no longer the great mandarins in Canberra, as we saw in the Defence Department issue over the children overboard thing and so on. They're not there anymore. Those things would not have been allowed to happen in the Australian public service 10 or 15 years ago, 20 years ago certainly, because they just wouldn't have done it the way they did. Now, Chairman, all these things seem to me to be serious issues of public policy in Australia, and I'm sorry if I've spoiled people's lunch in any way, but I do think we have to think about them in a much harder way than we have in the past. I was brought up as a Presbyterian, and we had a preacher who used to say he didn't mind people looking at their watches during his sermon, but when they shook them to see if it stopped, he got very upset. I saw Richie Gunn shaking his watch a minute ago, so I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you, John Button. I think when your committee invited John Button to speak, that we felt you would find it stimulating, and perhaps we don't do that enough. I'll return to that theme when I thank John Button after questions. I'm glad you raised the issue of Gough Whitlam, because I remember in the dying days of the Whitlam Prime Ministry, I went to a press conference, and there was a lot of talk about the demise of the Labor Party, which in fact happened. And some reporter at this press conference, I can't remember who, it was in Sydney, said to Gough Whitlam, "Tell me, Prime Minister, what would happen to the leadership of the Labor Party if you were run over by a bus?" And Gough said, "Well," he said, "that's extremely unlikely given my government's urban transport policies." We'd like to have some questions, please. Media questions first. Rex Jury, you're first. Away you go. Rex Jury from the Advertiser.
two questions. Perhaps about the two things you'll be most familiar about. First is, from a South Australian perspective, are you now confident that we can hang on with the car industry in Australia as it stands, more particularly with the exhibition, to remain in South Australia as a viable car manufacturer? And secondly, now that you've retired from politics, your major interest still tennis and roofing.
I can't find words to deal with the second part of this question, except to say, what will be a very hostile audience, the question and the original question asked me by Doug Aitken reveal something of what ordinary people feel about the filthy press in this country. Because I thought I was having a private lunch with Doug Aitken, and I thought he was probably bored, and I certainly was, I thought I might lighten the conversation somewhat, and I must say it shocked me profoundly when I read this allegation in The Age. I mean, I did say it, but I mean, I was sort of blokey sort of thing, you know. I shudder to admit to blokey sort of things with women here, but that happened. And I'm very sorry you raised it, Jim. Look, I don't know about Mitsubishi, but I think the automotive industry is very viable in Australia at the present time, and it's to the industry's credit, you know. You can sort of do things about industries as a politician or as a minister. You can try and suggest certain parameters and what they ought to do and so on. But it's up to them to do it. And the automotive industry, I think, has been very good in doing it as a whole. Now, nobody knows with certainty about Mitsubishi in this current globalized world. I mean, its parent might well be taken over again with somebody making a different decision from the current one and so on. We never believed in Melbourne, for example, I think, that Ericsson's would close their highly efficient and very clever laboratories in Melbourne, as they did announced a week ago. These sort of things can happen. All I can say to you is that Mitsubishi makes good cars. And that's a sort of a tremendous thing compared with what the car industry used to be like. I mean, I grew up in a time when every Australian model that came off the line was called a lemon a month later. You know, do you remember lemons? And the automotive, we don't have a lemons anymore.
Called the
576, wasn't it? Well, there are a number of them, yes. So, I can't answer the question about Mitsubishi, but I hope they go well, and I think they seem to be doing better at the present time, and I wish them every success.
Any other media questions? Your name, please. I'm sorry, we haven't got a roving mic today, so pray come forward and speak. You're from the Advertiser, obviously. Your name is? Leanne Craig from the Advertiser. Go ahead.
Okay, well, what I was trying to say earlier is that there seems to me to be a superabundance of caution in Canberra on both sides. If you'd asked your question in 1964, at the time of the Vietnam War, it would have been an analogous question to the one you've just asked. Isn't the ALP sort of betraying the interests of this country and not resisting the downward thrust of communism and all that sort of stuff? And you would have, it was a very similar situation. Look, these sort of things are immensely sensitive because things change, you know, but if you look at the position which I understand the Labour Party have to adopted in Canberra on the war in Iraq, it has been from the position that Australia should not be involved unless the war was sanctioned by the United Nations, as the Gulf War was in 1991. I must say I was against the Gulf War, though I was a minister in the government. I dissented from the government view on it at the time. Robert Ray described me then as an East of Suez man, which I am. I'm an East of Suez man. I think has been a sensible differentiation point. But when circumstances change and atmospheres change, you wonder if the ALP will maintain that view, and I hope they do. And I hope we don't get involved in the war in Iraq. Look, let me put my old lefty view on this. I mean, I don't believe a war in Iraq might be in America's interest. They might be able to persuade the world that it's in their interest. It might be in other countries' interest. I don't think it's in ours. I mean, after all, we weren't publicly cheering for Saddam Hussein when he used chemical weapons against Iran. Britain and America were. We didn't turn a blind eye. In some ways, they're their problems, not ours, in my view. So I'm sort of a bit way out on this issue. I hope the Labour Party will establish a degree of differentiation, but these things are clouded by emotional issues, you know, like the tragedy in Bali and all that sort of thing, which has nothing to do with Saddam. Is what you do about Iraq, you know, nothing to do with that issue at all. But they're very difficult ones to deal with. Have I answered your question or have I squibbed it? Yes. I think so. It happened in 2001 in the election, you see. The Labour Party didn't have to say we want floods of refugees in this country. What they might have said is that people at Woomera should be treated better. You know, if they just said that, it would have been a point of differentiation with the government, yeah? But that didn't happen. And it's that sort of little thing that ought to be happening now.
I'm sorry, who's that? Oh, John? Okay. Yep, go ahead, John.
John Moore from Radio Adelaide. But my question this week in the South Australian students have been asked to report in the president. It seems that even though Labour left and Labour right, these factions of Labour Party are fighting out this type of position. They don't seem to be engaging with young students from the university community. What's your message for how can you fix this kind of differentiation that's been happening?
Factionalism, he wouldn't know about that.
Well, I said earlier that I think politics is essentially about ideas, and if there's one place it should be about ideas, it's in universities. But if groups within the universities seek support on the basis that they want numbers as distinct from ideas, that is something which I would imagine doesn't appeal and shouldn't appeal and shouldn't appeal. Now this is the basic success of the Greens. You know, they're essentially about ideas, one or two ideas only, but that's what they're about, and that's a very appealing feature about them amongst young people. But the young political apparatchiks in universities who take on the colour of their factional masters in the Labour Party are not doing anybody a service.
Okay. Any other media questions before we... Yep. From the advertiser, your name is...
I'd like to know from the advertiser.
Sorry, the last part was? Oh, Howard's reaction to the Bali bombings. How would you rate the Howard's reaction to the Bali bombings?
Well, you know, I don't think I would have any complaint about his reaction to that. I mean, there seemed to be a universal reaction in the Parliament. They all seemed to be saying the same thing. And I think that's probably all there was to say. I think if I might say so, I don't know enough about it, but I think if I might say so, there is too much haste to identify the villains. You know, I don't think we know enough about that yet. You know, so you get this sort of blurred thing where people start to think, well, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden and everybody else were all organizing this thing, you know. And terrible though it is, I mean, I think it's a bit early to identify those responsible in public utterances and say what you're going to do about them.
Thanks. I guess what's happened is quite different in a way to September the 11th. September the 11th, you could see on television and knew who did it. This one, I was talking to Rex Jory about this before we came in here. It's blurred and it's emerging, you know, step by step. And it's going to be very interesting, I guess, to see what happens over the course of the next week. Certainly, the death toll is going to rise enormously, and it's an enormous tragedy, which I think, in terms of numbers, equates with, in population terms, with September 11. Can we get the other media questions, please, members and guests? You, sir, have a question? Please keep your questions direct and as questions, not as statements, please.
On economic policy, feeding it to them, the right wing economic philosophy, economic rational. Now, feeding does not do that much.
Yeah, I want a question, please, not a statement.
But the market turns first. Financial deregulation and privatization is a tragedy and disaster. And the outcome is highly difficult from the time the decision was made. So we're not the Labour Party.
So the question is, when is the Labor Party going to apologise for Paul Keating's... I'm not sure you're asking the right person, but I'll give him a go at answering it.
Well, look, it's a sad thing. Every generation of Labor Party politicians, in a sense, apologises for their predecessors. I mean, I have to say, we're Gough Whitlam's government. I became a shadow minister after Gough left politics, but I mean... because of the disasters associated with the end of that government, nobody in what became the Hawke government wanted to know about it, you know. They weren't very kind to it. It's only with a mist of retrospect that you can see it in a more kindly light, I think. And I have to say that nobody wanted, in the Beazley-led government, wanted to have anything to do with what the Keating government had done. So that's a form of apology, but perhaps it wasn't directed sufficiently clearly to you personally. But it's a sort of form, I suppose, of national apology. But I'm not in the business of talking about what the present ALP should do about policy matters. I'm only concerned about two aspects of policy. One is that they should have an independent foreign policy, and the second is that they should do something about reinventing, if you like, or resurrecting the public sector as an important element in Australian political life.
Okay, sorry, I've got a question from Rex Jory. Rex? Please go ahead. Yes, I agree. He looks like a senator, doesn't he? The toga and all the rest of it, yeah. Did everyone hear that? Yes, okay.
Well, look, you know, I was trying to make the point earlier that whatever you think about state governments and their importance, they can make differences at the margin, you know, the class sizes in government schools or something like that, or a new freeway or something. But the whole issue of political values and ideas and ideals is really at the federal level of politics. You know, as somebody pointed out quite recently, you don't see the Liberal Party inquiring at the moment as to why they haven't got any state governments in Australia, whereas the Labor Party is endlessly inquiring as to why we don't have a federal government. And the reason for that is quite simple, because that's where the federal politics is where the important issues which determine the future of this country really are. The values of this country, if you like. Now, secondly, you asked me about whether we should come to a time when we don't have state governments. I mean, Whitlam was extraordinarily naughty about these sort of issues. He liked being naughty, Whitlam. That was one of his characteristics. And he once wrote that the function of state governments is to bring about their own dissolution. And, you know, there's a famous story about him coming down in a lift after a premier's conference with all the state premiers, and he looked down at them and he said, "Pissant state politicians." Now, these are just examples of naughtiness, in my view. But, you know, the question is whether Australia would be better served by a form of regional government, you know, sort of county governments, if you like. After the war, at the time of the Chifley government, the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, which was a very forward-looking department, divided this country into about, there'll be people here will know, but I think there are about 40, roughly, what they described as natural regions. You know, in Victoria, for example, there would be the Latrobe Valley and the fruit-growing regions on the Murray and Melbourne and so on, and there would be several in South Australia and so on. And what they were really suggesting is that the best way to deliver services to people in these particular regions was to places which have had some sort of economic cohesion and entity about them. Now, this idea has been around for a long time, you know, and it's still around. And it may be that there's a lot of sense in it. But is it realistic to talk about that? I think not. Interesting, but not realistic.
Thank you. Unless it's a very short question, I think we're out of time for questions. It's 2 o'clock and we've always made you a promise that we'd wind up at two. Is it a short one?
Is it not a matter of whether we agree with America, but whether we know which side our bread is buttered?
Okay, a quick answer, if you could, please, John.
Well, I think analysis of what is in this country's national interest would, in my view, determine which side our bread is buttered. And it would not be a side which has sort of mindless allegiance to the views of George Bush. Let me just say on this question, you know, you've got to be. I mean, when George Bush was elected, nobody thought he was any great genius, I have to say. And the problem with America at the present time is that George Bush has two sets of advisers who don't agree with each other. You know, they're always locked in disagreement, and Bush has to become the arbiter of that. Now, he's not the best person in the world, I suspect, to be the arbiter of those discussions. In Reagan's day, he had advisers who reached agreement before they advised him. And everything he said came from the sort of advice he got, which was unanimous almost, from his advisers. Now, Bush is in a totally different situation, and I wouldn't be happy about nailing our flag to a president like George Bush. I mean, what is he going to do for us if the upshot comes? What has he done for us in respect of trade? What has he done for us in respect of our farmers, in respect of our steel industry? After all the promises he made at the election, what's he done? And what will he do? Ultimately, if the crunch comes, he'll do what best suits him, not what best suits us. So that's the problem, I see.
Thank you, John Button. I can't resist before I ask Judith to come up and draw the raffle and do a few other things, just telling you one other Gough Whitlam story. Gough, I can't remember if he's Prime Minister or not, was in Federal Parliament, and somebody from either the Liberal Party or the National Party, I can't remember, interjected as Gough was making a speech. And as most of you know, unless the speaker responds, the interjections are not recorded in Hansard. And this interjector said, "Come on, Gough, tell us about the Labor Party's policy on abortion." As quick as a flash, Gough turned round and he said, "Well," he said, "in your case, it should be made retrospective." Thank you all for coming. And I'd like to say to John Button, by way of thanks, thanks for your time. Thank you for coming along. Thank you for giving us your wit and erudition. I suspect that most of my fellow committee members and our president, Don Riddell, would agree that maybe we don't do enough of this. Maybe we don't get enough people coming along and making us think about the issues of our times, people who haven't got a heavy agenda on their own side. So, John Button, you were very good, and I thought I would enjoy what you had to say, but I enjoyed it more than I thought that I would. I have a small gift for you. It is bigger than you are. It is the same product, the same bottle of Magnum, in fact, that we give to all of our speakers, a bottle of 1999 Orlando St. Hugo Kunawara Cabernet Sauvignon. If I was you, I'd put it away for a while, but not for too long. Thank you very much for speaking to us. Please join me in thanking John Button.
Thank you. The only other Magnum I have at home, I've had for about 10 years, and I told my sons we'd open it when Geelong won a premiership. It's getting pretty old now, I tell you.
Now, I think Judith's going to tell you a couple of things about upcoming events. We have I'll get Judith to give you the date. It's in November. I can't remember what it is. But love him or hate him, we have Peter Lewis, the Speaker of the South Australian Parliament, talking to us on Tuesday, November 19, in this very Novotel Hotel, which is always looked after very well. We've also had Alexander Downer of Baghdad, as Mike Carlton calls him, agree to speak to us. We don't know when yet, but he will speak to us, and that may be quite interesting in view of what may happen in the next few months. We are working on ideas for other speakers. Please, if any of you have those ideas, please talk to any of the committee members, Judith herself, Susan Karakousis, who's over here, who's been run off her feet the last few days, I should say, and let us know if you've got any ideas for speakers. We're always looking for good speakers. We schedule these events on the basis of our speakers, not on the basis of the third Thursday of the month or anything else, but when we have good speakers. John Button, you were fantastic. You stimulated our ideas. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, well, I need somebody special to draw this. Samela, come on. We make a great team. I sprung that one on her. Thank you. Scrub them all up. They're well mixed, I promise you.
Okay, we'll do the two things together. Orange D, Mandy Blewett.
D36, Mandy Blewett.
What are we drawing for?
The first one is the very lovely
multifunction cordless system from Telstra. It actually has an answering machine in it, and yes, we were lusting with it.
Oh, well,
we're very glad, and I have to say, there's a great competition for that one. There will be people sobbing on the floor now.
The next one is three bottles of Clarence Hill wine, bought in by Robert Main, as he always knows the very best about wine.
Tanya Borden.
Oh, this is good. Who's going back? The ties are too... She might have left in a hurry. Some of the ties are... No, she's coming. Well done.
Three bottles down here.
Now we have a carton of Hahn Premium Light.
Just be very careful when you open the box. My God, it's Tanya Borden again.
Yeah. Oh, she's having a party, guys.
Tanya Borden, sorry. Put it back, okay.
Thank you, Tanya. It was very sweet of you. Another one.
Julie Green.
Oh, Julie Green from Australia Post. Come on forward.
On the telephone?
No? Okay, fine. Thanks, Julie.
The last one is a black D36.
With no name. Oh. Black D36. Black D36. Oh, well done. Well done. So, don't know if you can... Yes, he's being anonymous. So just, if you want, you can take one of those and we'll leave the other one. Whatever. Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Now, just the last reminder, Tuesday, November 19, here at the Novotel, Peter Lewis on the Constitutional Convention should be very, very interesting. Thank you. Thank you.